CISOs are not landing a lot of board positions. My general, in a nutshell, thought about that isn't that there's a conspiracy against CISOs, isn't that the existing people filling boards, that they are trying to hold on and they're territorial and they don't want us to move in on their turf. I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's that we're awful.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? We interrupt the Adversarial Podcast to give you a special presentation where host Jerry Perullo spoke to the Avanta CISO Summit about board roles. While the full team will rejoin next week, we are confident you will agree we still found time to get adversarial.
CISOs are not landing a lot of board positions. It's pretty tough. Even for those of us that are untethered now, don't have to worry about the baggage of our day job, it's still pretty challenging. And some people are fairly publicly bellyaching about that, and others feel it's okay. We'll talk about the SEC regulations and what the expectations are of companies and how that may or may not be met by that trend. But look, my general, in a nutshell, thought about that isn't that there's a conspiracy against CISOs, isn't that the existing people filling boards, which is generally ex-CEOs, maybe some ex-CFOs as well, it's not that they are trying to hold on and they're territorial and they don't want us to move in on their turf. I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's that we're awful. I'm sorry, right? Because, I mean, if you say most, it's like when people say, it's not you I'm worried about with the driving, it's all the other people. Like, if you say that to a room, and most of the people are the other people, and so most of us are those CISOs that I was called awful. So I apologize for that, but I think there's hope, right? And it's that the people that are on the boards, and they're the ones that are hiring for board positions. So first of all, let's just get that straight. There's a nomination and governance committee, especially in public companies, and they're going to certainly screen the candidates. They might be proffered by senior management or recruiters or outsiders, but at the end of the day, they're going to be screening them. People are going to bring candidates that they think the nomination and governance committee and the NomGov, as it's called, chair will probably like. And very often, other directors or people on that NomGov committee will source a lot of the candidates. So that's really who's judging you and who you need to get to know to be able to get on there. And all of those folks have dealt with CISOs before. You know, I mean, I think we're far enough along now since CISOs have been around for 20 plus years that those folks, even as the ones that have been retired for 20 years, they met one at least once. They were probably a CEO and dealt with the CISO. They might have been a CFO and dealt with the CISO. And their interactions had benefit, you know, it was not all bad, but the one thing they took away was, God forbid that person was on my board. And the reason, and by the way, the good news is we're not alone. General counsels are struggling too. It's pretty cool. If you Google, how can a lawyer get on a board, you'll see them all lamenting and crying around in 2018 and 2019. It's awesome, actually. And you can use a lot of the tips that were given to lawyers back then now. Right? We're just rebaking the same thing. And I didn't even realize that until recently. But it's the same thing because GCs, general counsels general, I guess, and CISOs, among others, are meant to be risk managers, right? That's what we do. And I always would get frustrated with corporate counsel when they were what I call a cardboard cutout lawyer, which means they just stand there and you write no in a bubble and stick it on it. And I was like, I could do that job a lot cheaper. Yeah. So we're the same way, and when we just say no all the time, or more specifically, when we just kind of govern by tropes and memes about security and don't have business context and we're not truly doing risk management, that's bad, and that's why nobody wants us in those rooms. So the real secret to getting on a board, there's two pieces to it. One is macro and long game, and that's changing the perception of CISOs generally, so people will even look at us. And that's going to take a lot, and it's going to take time. And then the other is micro, and that's establishing your own personal reputation as someone who doesn't just say no all the time, but actually evaluates the risk of a situation. I was thinking of, like, what's a good example of this? And some of the ones I use are, like, is a 8-character password good or bad? I'm not going to trick you guys with this, right? But I'm just going to guess a lot of CISOs are going to say bad or not good enough. Another good one would be, is having Windows XP in the network good or bad? I think everybody's going to say bad. But I'm, again, it's kind of a trick question. I don't want to set anybody up for that. those aren't the right answers. Those things are not bad. Those are bad sometimes in context, right? Having Windows XP with unpatched vulnerabilities in a position where it could be exploited to further a negative mission that we are all caring about is bad. But, you know, what operating system is running this microphone or these screens or whatever? Nobody knows. Nobody cares. It's probably a lot crappier than Windows XP, but we don't really care because it's not really assailable, right? Context is everything. And you can just think of it in your interactions, especially with the CEO and the CFO and all these people who are going to be future directors, and then also with your directors, by not bristling, right? When people bring something up, don't immediately jump and say, oh, that's not secure. Always, and this is not just about getting on a board. This is about being a better CISO, being a better risk manager, right? Because the more you can enable the business to run, the better your bonus is going to be at the end of the year, right? We have to think about the top line too. So I've had this thought that I've wanted to like really gel, and I haven't fully baked it yet, so I'm just going to do it live here. But it's almost like a subtitle for this talk, and it would be the only CISOs people want on their board are Joe Sullivan and Tim Brown. It's a crazy, contentious subtitle, right? So the Uber and the SolarWinds CISOs, everybody will know that already, and the last session brought it up again, and I bet there's been four sessions today that mentioned one or both of those guys. But there's something to be said there, and I didn't come up with that just to like pop and make people like wonder what it is and then to kind of like get clickbait out of it. I came up with that because I was reading the indictment and the claim against them, respectively. And when I read, and let's start with Joe Sullivan's, because that's been around a lot longer, and when I read the play-by-play on what was going on there, I think there's some very specific actions in there that he would probably regret and that we're all learning from. And then we say, okay, good, now I know, I'm never going to do that. And some of them aren't brutal. Some of them are just, oh, I'm going to make sure I've got everybody in this together with me. I'm not going to take action unilaterally, whether it means copying people on an email or saying, hey, we're going to do this okay, and just making someone, a CEO or a general counsel, get on board with that. And that's pretty simple. But if you look at the rest of what's going on there, and anyone who knows Joe and knew Joe before then or after then knows that he's one of the best. He's an absolute subject matter expert. He's a great communicator. He has all of the stuff that we're all pursuing. And when you look at the indictment in there, you see some amazing cybersecurity CISO work going on. Like, for example, understanding the attack chain that was even presented to him and all of that. What he ultimately did was really stick his neck out there and get his head cut off, too, for the company. I mean, he wasn't, by the way, none of you have to worry about getting fired if there's a big breach. Right, we know that. We figured that one out all right. We survive. And by the way, the company survives too. Hopefully we all learn and get stronger. And we might even thrive. Right? People might say, oh, wow, you've been through the ringer. We want to hire you. And Joe was smart enough to know that. I don't think his actions were selfish. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to look like a bad CISO. It was, our company is going to suffer. And like it or not, he was looking out for shareholder value. It's kind of eeky to think about it, but I mean, it's really true. And if you pivot over to Tim, and you know, this is a quick, you know, genericizing or at least setting my with the way I'm talking about Tim's plight right now. You know, it was that he embellished their security claims to the point of fraud. And he said, "Oh yeah, we got everything licked." When he was talking to customers in particular, he closed deals on it, and he helped shareholders gain assurance. And that wasn't really true, and that he knew it. That is, I've been on both sides of that table so many times, including M&A due diligence. And the cool thing about the M&A due diligence type of third-party risk management is that after you get all the answers to your stupid questionnaires and after you formulate an opinion about whether it's good or bad, in M&A, you get to see the truth, right? You close the deal. And by the way, that's not simple either. When you close the deal, people still try to push you out and still try to hide stuff. But I've been through $30 billion of M&A and got to see it. And it's always Tim Brown style. Or worse. Now, and I've seen, it's funny, at ICE we used to get, this was a metric. Everybody thinks about metrics. Here's one that you might not be tracking. The number of questionnaires you answer. We did 150 a month for a long period, steady state. It was just nuts. And we issued a much smaller number than that because we had the same people do both and they learned. But, I mean, the state of marketing, I mean, anybody who's bought moisturizer that's called calming knows that marketing can embellish things quite a bit, right? So for all the negative things and all of the problems and things that certainly the individuals learned and that we can learn from their plights, there's something there that we shouldn't lose sight of. And that's the fact that they were trying to grow the top line. They were trying to close business. They were trying to close deals. And that's what people want to hear about in the boardroom. Now, there's ethical ways to do that, without a doubt. But if you're, I mean, and everyone's been drug along in a sales call or something like that, and that's where you're really making your bones. So when board directors think of us, they can't be thinking of us as just, and Bob, I'm going to throw you under the bus. I can't see a thing, so even if I could find you, oh, there you, I see some hands under the lights. I'll throw you under the bus because you gave me some great material. But Trey had handed over the iPad, and it was locked. And she said, oh, the passcode is bam, 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 bam. And she rattled off something that was super trivial and light. And he gave her a hard time because we were at a CISO summit. So he showed up. So way to go, Bob. I can't blame you. It was funny. But if you take that seriously, that was, if you pretend that Bob was really caring and that he issued a finding and he called internal audit and all that crap and he was a whistleblower about it, that would have been wrong. That would have been the Bob that they don't want on a board, right? Because he hadn't taken context in, right? In reality, the correct answer is probably that it shouldn't have had a passcode on it at all. Or maybe that it was great to have a sticky note with the passcode on it. Because who cracks into iPads? I mean, you all read threat intelligence all the time. Where's the article about the iPad getting an easy-to-guess pass pin in there? You know, it's just, we're working off of tropes too often. So we need to start saying, well, hold on, let me think about the context of that, what we're trying to do as a business. And I think it really starts with dismissing things. It's not about coming up with more things to worry about. Boards hate that too. It's about putting them at ease about the 80% of the news cycle that they actually don't need to worry about. Right? One of the things that drove us, so I was in critical infrastructure as a stock exchange, futures exchange, a bunch of things. We're actually two different designated infrastructure entities, critical infrastructure entities. And the narrative was driven, especially here in Atlanta, around data theft. Right? Cybersecurity is equal to data security. And people are push that all the time. And sorry, there's a lot of vendors here that have to push that message because if you're in a data security business, you better convince the world that everything is data security. The data in a stock exchange or anything like that is not super actionable for the bad guys. Now, a board doesn't want to go and say, we don't care about data security. No. But the reality is things like what encryption at rest, which is the worst thing ever, but these classic data security plays and are irrelevant, but it was a problem because when you're actually worried about sabotage, right, state actors and critical infrastructure, you are. That's what you're trying to worry about, is someone shutting down the exchange, maybe in a far-fetched model, putting in fake numbers, but you can shut everything down and you're back to the availability issue. But it was hard to get executives to get past the news cycle about Equifax. Right? I mean, I was literally on an elevator, and I worked in an office that had, I don't know, maybe 1,500 people or so to give you like a general scale, like a 12-story building. So 1,200 people and the queen bee, the CEO, that's one person out of the colony. So you run across them fairly rarely in person. And I remember getting on the elevator with the CEO, and it was just one of those moments where you're like, ugh, I didn't prepare a script here. What am I going to do? And it was right around the Equifax breach, and he said, hey, and I think he was thinking, oh, shit, I'm talking to the CISO here. I don't have a script. So he said, that Equifax breach, huh? Yeah, I heard encryption is the answer to everything. And I just thought, oh, the clock is on. I've got about 10 seconds to explain to him that if we get sidelined by vendors and everyone else into just talking about encryption for the next two quarters, we're going to get eaten alive by the entire planet of people who want to shut down the Western economy, right? Hate capitalism, hate the United States, hate, there's so much hate against things that the stock exchange represents. And data security has very little to do with that. So when you're in that boardroom, you have to be able to bring to them when they say, hey, did you hear about the XX breach or whatever it may have been? What's today? The Snowflake thing, right? Everybody's thinking about that. There's a number of breaches of Snowflake customers, and the one common thread they have is that they were all using Snowflake. And when you get that question, think about it. Think about how you would answer that to the board director who says, do you know about that, and could that happen to us? And don't bias toward, oh yeah, that's the biggest deal in the world. You know, bias toward, maybe that's not relevant to us. And if so, why? I think about the victims, Ticketmaster, I can't remember the other ones, they'll come to me in a minute, but they're data plays, right? The Ticketmaster breach was 500 million records of PII. That's where that problem started. Right? Nobody's going after someone with 1,000 employee records of PII and going through that whole kill chain that involves Snowflake. And so if you can answer that to, you don't want to be dismissive or defensive, but if you can answer that with, oh yeah, the companies that are targeted in that have a ton of PII, and as a result, data security is one of their primary objectives, and one of the objectives of the adversaries is to get to their data, and so they're always figuring out a new attack chain, and they figured that one out. The good news is we only have our employees when it comes to PII. We're not in the PII business, so it's very unlikely they'll pursue us. But, and then of course that's where you add the, we always evaluate our vendors and we're checking, et cetera. But to just say like, oh yeah, we are abandoning Snowflake, or good thing we don't use Snowflake because they're insecure, is the wrong answer. And not just on the micro level, but it telegraphs that this is going to be a bad risk manager in a boardroom as well. So I think it all starts with, you know, with that bit of coaching of, you want to be a risk manager first and kind of a Chicken Little or a panic at the last resort. All right, so now some pretty tactical bits about boards, and let's talk about the new SEC rule for a second. So people think about that a lot. I think I'm in second place between Ernst & Young and PwC for the number of comments on that whole rulemaking process. So I got involved in that super early because I wasn't a CISO, but that's one of the things you could do. Right? How many of you would feel free writing a public comment letter to the SEC about cybersecurity regulation? Right? How many traps would you have to run? It's not worth it. But when you're on your own, you can just write a letter. It's pretty cool. Run it by nobody. It's awesome. So I did that, and it's great. I mean, as a matter of fact, they address some of my comments directly in the final rule and kind of bend it around, and you're welcome for that, because what I think it was is they had asked to be able for companies to disclose their policies and procedures to the investing public. And I said, you know, you really want them to like talk about their program and make it more generic, and we landed on processes somewhere in the middle, and that's what's live. But some people are upset that the SEC rule didn't require cybersecurity expertise, because it doesn't. The SEC final rule says it requires public companies to disclose any cybersecurity expertise on the board, which means you're totally compliant if you don't have any cybersecurity expertise on the board. Now, don't panic about that, though. I worked in New York Stock Exchange, so I noticed pretty well. We always talked about the long tail of listed companies, right? You got your S&P 500, you got the companies that we all think of, you got the companies that unfurl the banner over NYC, but there's thousands of companies that are publicly traded companies with a market cap of less than $1 billion. They're pretty small. They probably don't have a very big board. Interesting, weird example, if a lot of you will be familiar with the company Unify, Ubiquity. Check out their corporate governance. It's 70%+ owned by one person, the founder, so he could do whatever he wants within the confines of the law, but it's a publicly traded company. They have 3 board directors. Right? Are they going to hire a CISO and you know, increase by 33% the headcount on the board? And there's a lot, it's different horses, or different courses for different horses, or vice versa. But it's back to that same thing where everything should be risk assessed. So for some companies, they don't need a CISO or a cybersecurity expert on the board. They don't have the bandwidth to go through that. And we should approach everything like that. Like, okay, what's right size? Now, if you're a big cybersecurity play, if you're Snowflake and they had been culpable in this, and they're not super culpable on that. They allowed customers to create single-factor credentials. Ah, that sucks. I think they regret that. That's as bad as it got. They didn't have a vulnerability, they didn't have bad incident response, they didn't have an intrusion within Snowflake or anything else like that. But let's just say that they had, and they were kind of like SolarWinds. Then if their disclosure of cybersecurity expertise on the board was, we don't have any, then it would look bad, and it would get bad. But it's not that everybody has to have a cybersecurity expert on their board right away. So I think that's fine, but it's still pushing things in the right direction. People are definitely looking for cybersecurity expertise when they're recruiting for board positions, which is all we really wanted. We didn't ever want them to say you have to have a CISO on every single board, and I'm telling you, it would be really bad for shareholder value in general. But I think we're headed in the right direction. So there is a lot of interest in that. And what's interesting is that most of the rules are not only about cybersecurity expertise on the board, but people talk about the disclosure rules that are in there too, right? The 4-day to tell shareholders, the public, but shareholders, if something is a material event. And we all got wrapped around the axle on the definition of materiality, and that's good, and we should be thinking about that. But then there's the whole other maybe 60% of that rule, which is about companies disclosing their program, disclosing their processes, disclosing their program of risk management. So companies need a lot of help with that. So shy of board work, that's something that people should be thinking about right now and go through and start looking at the 10-Ks. It's not the 8-Ks. It's not the, oh, panic, something happened. It's just a normal annual report. Start going through that and seeing how that's starting to flesh out and describe the program more. And not only is that somewhere where you can help and add expertise and be on a board and be able to say, are we writing the right level of detail? But it's something where if you're working on it today, especially at a public company, then that's something you could cite later. You were involved in the authorship process. So if you're at a public company, you should definitely have a hand. And I'm not saying they should reach out to you and your company's stupid if they don't involve you. Mm-mm. If they're not involving you, there's a reason there, and it's your fault. Sorry, but I mean, that's everything in life. Everything's our fault at the end of the day. And if you think that way, you'll get somewhere. So if they're not reaching out to you, something's off. One thing that does work is if you just write the 10K section on your own. It's kind of crazy sounding, but if you do a good job of it and you open up the discussion with counsel and say, hey, I was looking at our 10K. I don't know if you knew about these new SEC rules and all of that, but you know, I had some ideas of how we can edit it. That's a cool way to open up that conversation. But it's just like the board thing where if they think of you as the voice of no and whistleblower all the time, they're not going to want you in on that authorship. So it's kind of a cool way for you to, at a very early stage, see, am I getting the right take on the way I approach things so that I'm invited into those discussions? So that's a pretty cool early way that you can get into and start building some skills towards being on boards. So now some tactical things that you could do today to get on boards. I thought about getting on public company boards maybe 2015-ish, something like that. And what I recognized I should do was get on any kind of boards I could while still the CISO of ICE and the New York Stock Exchange, because I figured that's my card, that's cool, people will see it, and once I'm out of there, I'm chopped liver and no one will care about me. So I started figuring out what I could do, and at the time we were super restricted from serving on any board, so that was that. We could do not-for-profit boards with the CEO approval, even that had some hair on it. Not-for-profit boards generally aren't super helpful for being on a public company board, sorry. Most not-for-profit boards are fundraisers. That's why there's 23 board directors, right? Because they all wrote a $5,000 check to the preschool or whatever it's gonna be. That's not super helpful, but what you can look for are these fringe companies that kind of straddle the line, that are not-for-profit but operate like a for-profit company, that have to worry about profit and loss, might deal with some contentious issues. In my case, I joined the ISACS board. So I was in financial services, the FS-ISAC. I joined that board, and that was great. So we went through a CEO transition. We had to manage budget. We had to work with the Intel community. We had to build a SCIF, a compartmentalized information facility. So tons of legitimate board work. And what I did there, which I'd recommend highly, is I then restructured the board to emulate a public company. Before that, we were just like your country club, right? There was a president and a treasurer and secretary and all that. That's not the board you want to be on. I mean, you should be on those two, but not to get on, you know, the Monsanto board. So what we did, we changed it around. We established an audit committee. We established a risk committee too, which we're in financial services. That's pretty common. Comp committee and so on. We established a chair for each of those. We were a lot more transparent about the election cycle. And so, and with the 15 or so directors all being CISOs and CIOs of big financials, we all had the same ambitions. We were all trying to get on board, so we all agreed, yeah, let's do that. Let's turn it into one. So how did I figure out how to do it? I went to NACD. There's Bob Zukas has a digital directors network, I think it's called. And then there's also universities. As a matter of fact, I'm working with Georgia Tech. I'm building a director cyber ed thing for this fall, moving pretty quick. Stanford has one, MIT has one, and so forth. If you go through some of those programs, that can really help to not only help prepare you to be on a board, And not only help give you some material, so if you want to turn your not-for-profit board, it'll tell you exactly, like, the, especially NACD, they publish these amazing guides on how to structure your comp committee or whatever it's going to be. And they let you use it if you're a member for your company, so it's all pretty clean. But the third thing one of those will really do, and I think this is the most essential way to start thinking about it now while you're CISO, I did not push, I never did any training, right? I mandated training for my employees. I actually had the GRC department have a spreadsheet and say, hey, you haven't gone to your Black Hat training this year. Do you want to make it up? I forced people to go because, you know, they won't. No matter. First they want budget, then you give them budget, and then they don't go. So I did all that, but I didn't go to anything because it was pretty rare. When I did, it was usually free or I was invited or whatever. So I certainly wasn't going to ask for $14,000 to go to the Stanford board course so I could get on a board when I quit, right? That didn't feel right. It felt really selfish. In hindsight, I was totally wrong. I should have asked for the company to pay for me to get board education. Because, yeah, there's something in there for us all to bail and get on a board later. Yeah, that's true. And by the way, everybody you're asking for permission is in the same boat, CFO, GC, CEO. They all have the same trajectory anyway. So they're going to be somewhat sympathetic even if they don't admit it. But more importantly, those things prep you for talking to your board today. So when you go in and you talk to the audit committee, if that's what you're stuck doing, so to speak, or the risk committee, if you have one of those, you'll understand the other 80% of the agenda that came before you walked in the room, and it's so helpful. It'll give you the language of that board, what their main concerns are, and it will change your presentation, the vocabulary that you use, the types of metrics that you bring. So do pursue those. I did the NACD Accelerate program. I thought it was awesome, and it's the only thing they offer for non-sitting directors. But it'll prepare you to be a much better CISO interfacing with your directors.
Adversarial enough for you? Stay tuned for the return of the whole gang and more cyber commentary. Thanks for tuning in.